Hello and welcome back to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One, Mark. And we have another person tonight that is not a Mark. Mr. Matt Sakaris joins us on the podcast tonight, guys. Coincidentally, episode 250. I just checked it in the catalog. So, Matt, you're joining us on a very, I guess, an auspicious day, which is really kind of cool. But we got a lot of stuff to talk about. And this is really cool because, if you're in Vancouver, you'll know who Matt Sakaris is and his longtime broadcast partner, Blake Price. Blake isn't here. Apparently, he was just outside standing on the porch with a microphone, and I told one of the kids to tell him he had the wrong house, but, it got a little bit awkward there. But joking aside, welcome aboard, Matt. It's great to have you here tonight.
Well, Mark, thanks for inviting me. I must say, I was so happy to see that there was F1 digital space and podcast work being done here in Vancouver in my own backyard. So it's awesome to connect with a couple of BC F1 fans, and 250 for you. I believe tomorrow is episode 50 for us of the new show, Sakaris and Price at sakarisandprice.com. And we nearly did 10 years at 1040. So milestones all around, fellas. Congrats.
That's awesome. And likewise, I don't really want to go back and circle back around the traumatic experience that was the sudden demise of Team 1040. But, it's really
Thank
great
you,
to
Mark.
See. You're welcome. But it's really great to see that that you and Blake were able to pick it up and, basically pick up where you guys left off, and as did a lot of the other people that were working at 1040 before. So it's really kind of cool, like you say, that we were talking about it just off air just now, that we're finding more and more that there is an F1 community here in Vancouver. But just for the benefit of our audience, because basically we get listeners and viewers from all four corners of the globe, and this is a good time because this is a show that we rely heavily on puns. So this is the time to establish your street cred. If you're looking for sophisticated humor, you're not going to get it on this show, I'm afraid.
Gotcha. You've set the tone.
I have, sadly.
I look forward to Hamilton. Good F1 name, incidentally. I've been a fan of the sport almost all my life, like 35 plus years, for sure. 40, coming on 40 years here. We're a Montreal family on both sides. My dad's family had a little, they'd call it a chalet. We'd call it a cabin in British Columbia, in the Laurentian Mountains of Quebec, Saint-Agathe, which is right near Circuit Mont-Tremblant, the legendary track up there that has produced so many drivers, even hosted a couple of F1 Canadian Grand Prix back in the day. So my dad would go to races there. And my grandfather on the other side, my dad's father-in-law, really the only moments of peace that my poor grandmother and mother got between the two of them, was when the Formula One race was on, because he was a Brit and he was a fan of motorsport. And so I had influences on both sides sort of steering me towards the sport. So knee high to a grasshopper, I went to a couple of Canadian Grand Prix back in the early 80s.
Oh, cool.
I believe Nelson Piquet won one, if not both, and have just followed the sport since. I can go back to the days when I was on tape delay, like late at night on a Sunday night on CBC, and back to the old days on TSN with Vic Browder. So it's been really rewarding to watch this. Like, it's more than just an uptick, right? Like, it is a pretty heavy surge here of popularity in F1. When you take a look at some of the numbers that TSN is doing now for this sport on a Sunday morning, like early on a Sunday morning, in the Pacific time zone, and how it's sort of growing globally and with young people and on social, thanks to Drive to Survive. So,
yeah, exactly.
Amazing time to be an F1 fan right now.
And I have to ask as well, and I don't know if our listeners necessarily have enough context, but you yourself, you've been deeply embedded in professional mainstream sports media for years and decades. From your perspective, because For myself and Mark Daly, we've kind of lived in this cocoon, this F1 cocoon for the better part of our lives. And, we surround ourselves with people that are passionate about F1. So we kind of have this ecosystem. But for us, it seems like that ecosystem now is expanding exponentially. From your perspective, are you starting to see the coverage, the interest permeate the mainstream media? Because for us, we attract people that have an interest because that's our principal responsibility. But from your perspective, what are you seeing?
Yeah. So you're so right, Mark. Like, I've been involved in Canadian sports media and newspapers and radio for 20 years. And like, I have barely talked the sport on my show. I have barely written about the sport for the print outlets that I worked for. And really, when you don't have to go too far back, like, there was very little of F1 in the Canadian mainstream sports media. You know, Journal de Montréal, certainly with Jacques Villeneuve, and the French press covered it pretty religiously. I covered a Super Bowl once with a writer from Journal de Montréal named Dominique Fougère. And he used to be on the F1 beat. Like, and I used to say, good God, like, that's the best beat in the world. around the world on somebody else's dime covering these races. You know, Toronto Star did a little bit. And of course, TSN, you know, would show the races and maybe even have a preview show. But it's nothing like it is now. And, you know, on my show now, I do get people, like, they know I'm an F1 fan now a little bit. So we do get people submitting. You know, we have a lot of audience feedback segments. And we have an audience that likes F1 and will throw things at. So Blake and Andrew, our producer, have had to sort of get a little bit literate about the sport, which I'm not sure they would have had to prior to Drive to Survive. In fact, even Ray Ferraro, one of the top hockey commentators in Canada, has said on our show, my family has all watched Drive to Survive. It's amazing storytelling, and now we're huge F1 fans. So it's been really cool for me to see the conversation increase in volume and in sophistication. And it's also been really cool to see it infiltrate the mainstream media a little bit. You know, but frankly, Mark, I'm not sure it needs the Canadian mainstream media. It's a nice to do, for sure. It's kind of the last frontier, I would say, USA and Canada, in terms of the areas that F1 wants to conquer, that it's not, you know, where it's not already a huge sport, although, you know, there's always China, India are so big. But I'm delighting in conversations like this. And I'm so pleased to see, you know, a couple of Canadian guys hosting an F1 podcast here in my hometown.
Well, you know, it's so cool too. Like you're saying, the whole Drive to Survive phenomena. We've actually coined the term Gen DTS. We get so many people tweeting us and emailing and getting in touch, and it's just like I watched DTS. I loved it. I found your podcast, whatever. And then I keep getting like phone calls and text messages for people I've literally known my whole life. And they've known that I'm a big sports guy in general, but F1 is probably, you know, one of my top two favorite sports. I'm soccer and Formula One are my two favorites. And I don't know what it is, if it's just a function of the pandemic and people are just going to different content that they would have maybe not have consumed otherwise. But I've heard from so many people over the last year, there's like, I watched the first season, I've been hooked, and you know, now I'm on to season two. And my good friend Jorge, he's from Mexico, who I did the soccer podcast with for years. I mean, he's just like, no football, no hockey, no basketball, no nothing else. It's just soccer, 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 soccer. And he texted me the other night. He said, I sat down with my wife to watch season one of Drive to Survive, and I binged watched, and now we're on to season two. He's just like, this thing is amazing. I can't believe what I've been missing. I'm like, well, dude, you know, you've got like a Mexican driver in Formula One.
I thought you had a national hero there, Carlos Slim's favorite investment.
Yeah, exactly,
Sergio.
Right.
Great track, too. Very interesting grandstand. No, you know, like, here's the thing. I'm in an F1 pool at my old work. Like, the guy who fired me, he's the pool administrator. You know, like, we text about the races, and we did shortly after he fired me.
That's so amazing.
You know, those sorts of things I never conceived of. And, you know, the other thing that's most encouraging, you know, not that we don't matter in Canada, but we're only so many people, only so commercially viable. You know, now this Miami Grand Prix is going to join Austin. I saw something really, really intelligent from a marketing point of view, a couple months back for the start of the F1 season, Aston Martin got two of ESPN's television radio personalities into their cars in Los Angeles on like Rodeo Drive and things like that. But they picked Marty Smith and Ryan McGee. Marty and McGee. And like Marty and McGee are like two good old boys from Tennessee and North Carolina, right? Like they are NASCAR as, you know, they speak and oil comes out, that sort of thing, NASCAR. And so they're sort of like, you know, driving around, having fun, top down, shades on in LA as people are noticing them. And obviously understanding, you know, at some point they're in an Aston Martin and, you know, that's a Formula One team. But, you know, that sort of really smart marketing in terms of how they're going to get the United States on board. And look, I don't know about you fellas, but when I started watching Drive to Survive, I was like, wow, this is, I watched it through an F1 lens, a longtime F1 fans lens. I was like, wow, this is amazing storytelling. This is amazing access. This is amazing candor. This is amazing bravery and courage and character development and all the good things, all the things that good storytelling requires. But at no point was I sort of watching it going, this is going to turn F1 into a crossover hit. Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear the two of you on that, because we've now all heard so many stories about I got into F1 because of Drive to Survive, and the pandemic may have been a part of that, Mark. But I did not sort of realize until sort of the build up to season 3 that it had already had such a deep and dramatic effect across a broader segment of the population.
You make such a terrific point. And just to provide a little bit of context for our listeners, I think it's important to kind of look at some of the early numbers that ESPN and TSN have been seeing. So TSN is the national broadcaster in Canada. They're seeing numbers around 520 to 550,000 people per race, plus 20% comp. The US is seeing plus 40, plus 50% comps. They're hitting 1 million viewers per race. Now, those numbers are a little bit skewed because they don't account for the number of people who are watching on legal streams or illegal streams. And let's be honest, there's probably a big segment of the population that's accessing these races illegally. And we're not factoring for that. But I totally agree. And I never imagined when Netflix announced this series, and I think they announced it probably in 2016, 2017. And I remember some of the early kind of background shots of the crews and the pits. Never for a second did I think that this would be anything but an off-season marketing vehicle that would have very, very, very low curb appeal. The fact that it took on this cultural cachet in a way that it has is something that I never would have predicted. Never, never, never. And I think a big part of that is, one, the storytelling, whether it's accurate or not, is incredibly compelling. Mm-hmm. And I think if it was released 20 years ago, the result would possibly have been different, simply because you get to see a snippet of the drivers. But I think the access to the drivers via social media today helps unlock and connect you with their personalities in a way that maybe you wouldn't have been able to before. And I always say that if you look back to 2006, and it was Talladega Nights, the Ballad of Ricky Bobby, or the Ballad of, I can't even remember how to describe it. But the whole concept of that film is you have this pretentious European Formula One driver that comes over to compete in NASCAR against the good old boys. But ultimately, that really summed up the perception of Formula One 20 years ago, which is, you know what, Formula One's a little bit stuffy, it's not accessible, it's a little bit pretentious, they're all white, wealthy, Western European drivers. It wasn't accessible in the way it is now, but I think the combination of the Netflix show, which made it accessible to everybody because everyone has a Netflix account, in combination with social media, has brought in an audience that maybe we wouldn't have seen before. And the really, really important thing for F1 is it's the right demo, right? What we don't want is the Major League Baseball demo. You watch a Major League Baseball game and 60% of the commercials are for lawn fertilizer. That's not the demo you want. The demo that Formula One's attracting is younger and it's vibrant and it has some degree of disposable income. And I think it just goes to your earlier point too about Liberty, right? Like when Liberty bought Formula One, ultimately, they had a couple ways to increase the value of that as a property. You could continue to squeeze your existing race organizers for additional hosting fees. You can put races in new locations, or you can tap in, just like you said, to North America, where they hadn't even scratched the surface of the potential financially.
Well, and Mark, like the thing is here's something that does cross over with my daily line of work covering North American sport. this is the last frontier for soccer as well.
Yep.
Yes.
It is quite simply viewed as a European sport that is just now really getting any kind of real foothold and is doing a pittance of the viewership on television that Formula One is now. The other thing relevant to the ratings is that it's on so early in the morning up and down the West Coast and the Midwest. Like, you know, there is a lot of DVR viewing on F1 as well. On top of the people who are watching and live. And, you know, in terms of Drive to Survive, like, I would argue, Mark, it's because the storytelling was so accurate. Like, because you were like, holy bleep, I can't believe they're doing this story about Alex Albon's mom and going to jail. And, like, yeah. You know, no, but honestly, like, you know, there were some people in the paddock who opened up some of their deepest, darkest, you know, like Seb Vettel sitting in the Ferrari driver meeting after having announced that he's moving to Aston Martin and them having sort of the PR pregame chat.
Yeah.
That's the sort of thing I never thought I would see as an F1 fan. And even if you don't know the sport, it was reasonably jarring sort of. It's, you know, I've heard it called perfect reality television. And I think that's right because, you know, it's, F1 has always had flair. It's always had glamour. You know, it's always had excess. And it's always had spoiled brat drivers to some degree and the feuds therein. So it's sort of been a perfect, it's been a perfect kaleidoscope of sort of things that appeal to a North American audience.
Yeah.
Now. And yeah, no, like I, you know, in preparing for this pod, I was thinking about it, you know, guys, like I think there are going to be some significant investments from Liberty and from some of those auto manufacturers and some of those drivers and just everything about Formula One, I think, is going to invest pretty heavily here in North America over the next few years because I think this is the area, this is the corner of the globe with the U.S. that, you know, has the most growth potential. And quite frankly, you know, the U.S. is still the economy that you want to be deeply embedded in.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great place to leave it for the moment. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, I've got a bunch of other things, including an email from our favorite listener, Bitter Brad in Pittsburgh. He's got a question for us. So we'll do that right after the break. So don't go away. And we'll be right back.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time, or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
All right. Well, welcome back, everybody. And Mark, you seem you've refreshed yourself. I guess you're all ready to go. But before we dive into the mailbag here, I just wanted to pick up on a couple of things that that Matt was talking about just before the break. And you know, the one thing that I totally agree with, basically everything Matt was saying. But the storytelling is so compelling. But there's one thing that I don't know if this really has been mentioned too much, because when the series first came out, I thought for people like us that were already very invested, very interested in Formula One, I thought this was niche content, and it didn't really necessarily take off in the first season. It's kind of, you know, it's been a bit of a slow boil, but especially since this last season came out, it's been exponential in the growth. And it really is kind of interesting too, because the people that produced it, the Box to Box Films, they also did that documentary about Ayrton Senna that came out well, it's at least 5, 6, 7, maybe even 8 or 9 years ago, and basically detailing his entire life and up to his tragic death at Imola in 1994. And the storytelling in that film is just as compelling and just as good, because when I watched that film, and I've tried to watch it a couple of times, that I've gotten to the point where they retell that that tragic weekend at Imola, when first we lost Ratzenberger and then we lost Senna a day later on race day. You know, the storytelling is so good, and the way that the film is done, that the emotions, you know, get very, very real. And the Paul Martin's the director, that he's obviously very talented in telling all these stories. And what I find so fascinating about DTS, that he's pulling on all these different threads, and he's able to sort of keep them going across multiple episodes and kind of tease you, even though there might be one specific episode, like Matt was just saying about about Sebastian Vettel and the whole move to Aston Martin, which I think was nicely summed up by Christian Horner, who said it's like breaking up with your girlfriend, but she's still living in your house, you know, which, you know, I thought was an interesting comment. But Mark, you would put a tweet out on our Twitter feed earlier today, and this is something that we've been talking about a little bit ourselves, and I think it works into nicely with an email from Brad, because there was a little bit of context for Matt. Last week on the show, Brad had sent in an email questioning about the use of PEDs in Formula One and stuff like that. And so then Mark, seeing that he's from Pittsburgh, immediately went to, you know, the lowest common denominator and dragged Barry Bonds into the conversation. So that's where it kind of went. Anyways, Brad, he starts off his email, or ends it, and saying that Barry Bonds can suck it, which I think everybody can agree with. But anyways, the question that he was bringing up is in relation to the new cars, the new regulations that are coming into Formula One for 2022, just kind of taking a look in the rearview mirror, you know, another nice little, corny metaphor there. He wanted to know, from the perspective of the cars, which is the best era of Formula One, in our opinions. I'll start off with mine. I particularly like the sort of the late 80s, you know, when you had like the McLaren Honda, the Williams Honda, the MP44, the FW11, all those sort of really classic, you know, like the Nigel Mansell, Nelson Piquet, Senna Prost at McLaren. But, you know, I realize at the same time that those teams, well, I guess it's no different than maybe the dominance we've seen of Mercedes over the past several years. But I mean, they were very, very dominant in those years. But I think for me that I tend to look at this maybe from more of a nostalgic and sentimental point of view, perhaps from the sporting side of it, when they got into that sort of Goldilocks zone, that this era from 1990 to 95 or 1960 to 1970, whatever it might be, where the cars and the regs were really spot on. I'd be interested to hear what either of you think on that topic.
Well, certainly when the 80s and the era you talk about with that whole gang, Prost and Mansell and that whole gang, it was a more difficult car to drive. Who are we kidding, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that was when you're manually shifting and all of that. I mean, that to me, that was sort of perhaps a bigger test of the driver. But if we're just talking about the cars and not just aesthetically, because what I always tell someone who doesn't know Formula One racing is the sound is just as incredible as the look mm-hmm. of the car. And the other thing, of course, they don't know is it's not just the way these things accelerate, it's the way these things break. And, you know, having spent many a Canadian Grand Prix in the casino hairpin there, you know, to watch them enter that corner, the first few times, it's like your eyes are deceiving you. Like, you legitimately think that the car is running into the gravel trap through the tire barrier and in the stands. Like, that's how fast it's going before it hits the. So I would say right now they have the best combination of look and aesthetic, and that includes livery. Just the way they maneuver is so sleek. Now it's beautiful. It's a little less ragtag, you know, sliding around a little bit as they used to. Although, you know, that has its value too. Back in the day, you know, when someone was really on some bad tires and just throwing the car all over the track. But, you know, about 10, 12 years ago, went to a couple of Canadian Grand Prix, and you had to wear the earplugs. And then they went to the hybrid engines, and I missed the one year my dad went, and he went, "Oh, it's terrible. I'm never going back. They sound like go-karts," right? We went a few years ago. We went 2019, I guess it was. And to me now, it's the perfect sound without being so ear-piercing that you have to put the earplugs in. The perfect look, the perfect maneuverability. Like I watch them now and I go, to some degree, this is the sport aesthetically and acoustically at its optimum.
Yeah, you know, the very first race that I went to was the 2001 European Grand Prix at the Nürburgring. And we were there for the entire weekend, but there was nothing like, you know, seeing the cars come down the hill into the hairpin on that that very first lap. And I was I went with about we went with a big group. I think there was about 8 or 9 of us, and you were all sitting there, and we're all big group of friends. So you're sitting there chatting, and of course, you know, when the race starts, you know, you've been talking to your buddy next to you, and you forget to put your earplugs in. And as soon as they came down into that, you know, hairpin, and as soon as they put the foot down on the accelerator, the shrill noise from the however many cars there was that year, 20 or 22, whatever it was, you know, almost 20 years ago, it was painful. It was literally painful. And we were all fumbling for our earplugs very, very quickly. And then my wife and I, we went to the Spanish Grand Prix in 2014. So the very first year of the new era.
And Mark, you've dragged her all over the planet. I can see where this is going, Mark.
Yeah, she's let's just put it this way. I'm a very lucky guy. Clearly came off as the worst of the deal. But, you know, the thing was, that weekend, I never put in the earplugs the entire 3 days that we were at the track. It was amazing contrast.
It's funny you mentioned that.
Yeah. Well, it's supposed to be, if you go live, it really should be a sensory overload experience.
Yeah.
Like, that's what you're paying for. And the tickets aren't cheap if you're going for a weekend. So you should be stimulated, your senses, in ways that they're not stimulated in other places. And, you know, to me, that's what's so great about sitting in a hairpin or sitting in an area where you see them decelerate to as slow as they're going to go into an area where they're up the gears and accelerating to as fast as they can go. Like, coming in the hairpin now in Montreal, they sound like spaceships. Like, it's an aviation noise. It's a jet engine noise on the way in and on the way out. So, it's just marvelous. Like, you know, I've had a lucky career in sports media where I've got to travel, certainly our continent, but a fair part of this world as well, going to different sporting events. And so I'm a little bit numb to a lot of the mainstream sports that are out there and the live experience. You know, Formula One is the one that I still have. Sorry, guys. Formula One is the one that where I still, you know, it stirs something in me that the others don't.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
And
yeah,
it's because, you know, there are some machines on track with some very, very skilled pilots who are doing things that it's really hard to conceive of. Your brain can't really process it all, and you're processing it for days and weeks afterwards.
You make such a great point about that. And this is a question we get from a lot of our listeners is, hey, we're new to F1. I want to take my family. I want to take my girlfriend. I want to take my boyfriend to an F1 race this year. What should I expect? And I remember back in 2016 in September, my wife and I went to the MotoGP Grand Prix at Silverstone, UK. And one of the things
so Mrs.
that
Hamilton's been dragged around the world too.
There's a common theme going on here.
All right.
We named our son Lewis. So I'll show you how deeply F1 runs in the family. But we went to the MotoGP race, and the sound and the sensation of those bikes, it rippled through your core. Yeah. And we went to the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix, the finale of this F1 season in 2016, a few months later in Abu Dhabi. And we're sitting in the primary grandstands immediately across from the garages. And the sound couldn't compare. Like, I liked the sound, but it wasn't that sensation. But we were back at a Grand Prix in 2018, and they'd done some revisions between the 2017 and 2018 season because there was so much negative feedback about what they'd done to the experience of F1 that it was back again. it was a completely different experience. I'm like, this is what I'm paying for when I'm sitting in a corner, when I'm sitting at Club Corner at Silverstone and I've got these cars attacking in the corner. I need to feel that, and my whole core needs to vibrate as those cars pass. And it was great that that sensation was back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, all I have to say to that is, you know, when you guys want to lend me the private jet to go over to Silverstone, Abu Dhabi, I'm in. You know, if you want to invite your old buddy Matt, I'd be happy to come. All I do is take Air Canada from Vancouver to Montreal once every June.
Don't worry. We'll make a few phone calls. We'll set it up. No problem.
Yeah. But honestly, I've spent a lot of time in Miami over the years. I've covered a number of events down there. It used to be a sort of a regular vacation spot for me. And I still have family that winters in Miami. In fact, I was just there a couple years ago, before this whole pandemic. What a magnificent spot for F1. And I'm familiar even with the course or near the football stadium. I've been in that football stadium a number of times. And it's tremendous because it's huge parkways that encircle, you know, an 80,000 seat football stadiums in what is really not actually that dense an area by Miami standards, population wise. So I really look forward to this race. I've been meaning to get to Austin. We were going to go to Austin this October. Alas, everything you know blew up. But I look forward to going to Miami, and you know. Austin for me has, as much as it's not really a Texas city, it's kind of been a little bit of a clunky fit with F1. It's not on brand, if you will, with Formula One. There are some there's some significant differences between Texas and F1. So it's been neat seeing those two cultures sort of collide a little bit. And I do like the track for the on-track excitement. There's been a lot of pretty good passes and racing there but you know, Miami is way more an international city, right? Mm-hmm. Like Americans don't see well outside their borders. That is not something America does very well. But Miami is such a melting pot, you know, a place where you hear Spanish before you hear English on the streets, that I think the F1 world is going to get to Miami. And I think that's going to be just a marvelous success.
Yeah.
In terms of having fans congregate on what is typically a pretty hot vacation spot and sunny destination to begin with. But also a city that has glitz, has glamour, you know, has panache like Miami does. So I've told my girlfriend that's our next trip. So maybe Mrs. Daly and Mrs. Hamilton can have some company.
So now there. So now the question is going to be, is it going to be your private jet or ours? So we got some details to work out here. Yeah. All right. Let's take a quick break again here, guys. And then I do want to go back. And Mark, I know you're just chomping at the bit there to talk about your proposal that you have for Liberty Media and this whole concept that we've come up with majors for the Grand Prix circuit. Anyways, we'll do that in just a moment as we take a quick break here. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Okay, well, welcome back to the show. You're with Mark and Mark, Daly and Hamilton, and also joining us is Mr. Matt Sakaris from Sakaris and Price, and we're talking Formula One. And Mark, we talked about it, or you actually kicked off this conversation on Twitter this afternoon, and so maybe you should take it from here. This is something we've tossed about, and we've talked amongst ourselves on the show previously, just the whole introduction of the sprint races that are coming in, and this concept that you have of making several premier of weekend events throughout the calendar, basically majors like you might see, say, on the pro tennis tour. And well, I don't want to steal your thunder. I've got a couple of opinions of my own, but why don't you take it, and then we'll weigh in on the discussion.
Yeah, I appreciate that, and I think one of the things that excites me most about Formula One right now is the ownership body in Liberty. I think Formula One in so many ways was being held back and really strangled by Bernie and his group. And one of the things I have to credit Liberty for is opening up the sport, making it more accessible, embracing social media, but they're also willing to try things on and off the track that I don't think the sports necessarily would have entertained in the past. And, you know, we're talking about things like qualifying sprints and all of those different kind of concepts. But one of the things that I think could potentially be really important for this sport is it needs to find a way to create an event or multiple events that transcend the calendar. And you see this in golf. You see this in tennis. You have certain, like, we all know what the four majors are in golf. You probably don't know the rest of the calendar unless you follow the PGA. Likewise, the broad sports community probably can pick out the four majors in tennis, but they probably couldn't kind of point out any of the other events on the tour. And one of the things that Indy does really well is, even though the bulk of its calendar, it's ovals, it's super speedways, it's road courses, even though in the eyes of most American consumers, sports consumers, it's pretty irrelevant, the Indy 500 event transcends sports. It transcends motorsports and it transcends sports. And it brings in an audience that you would probably never expect to see in that championship. And one of the things that we've been kicking around the last couple of months is how could or what could Formula One do to try to replicate that experience. And we've been talking about this concept of, you know, identifying four majors. The benefit to Liberty is, hey, look, if you want to host a major, you need to bid big dollars. You can charge big dollars, but you get some really cool benefits. You know what? You're going to have the exclusive access to a qualifying sprint race. You're going to have access to awarding double the championship points. So it means more to the teams. Like, you could do some really cool things with this. And then all of a sudden, from a marketing and a branding perspective, you've got four events that you can build your calendar around. Because what we've seen the last 6 or 7 years is there's some great races in the middle of the summer, but it's usually the dog days of Formula One at that point. The championships decided there's nothing compelling. But what if you were able to identify two or three or four races, brand them as majors, double the championship points awarded with them? What could you do with that from a marketing appeal to kind of broaden the exposure of the sport? But yeah, that's something we've been talking a lot about, especially in light of the Indy 500 last weekend, which was a blockbuster success by any standard.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mark, I love it. You know, as you were speaking about it, I found myself nodding my head, yes, yes, yes. And by the time you got to the end of it, it was so good. I was wondering when you were going to get a job with Liberty as the marketing officer. But the other thing that I, you know, that ran through my head as you were explaining it, and maybe this is because of my position being on talk radio here in Canada for the last 10 years, we are oftentimes guilty or at least accused of seeing things through a North American sporting lens. Now, the PGA Tour, I think it would certainly be through a North American sporting lens. That said, you know, tennis Grand Slams, they touch the world, right? London, Paris, New York, and Australia. I love the idea of double points for quote unquote major races. I think we all know Monaco has to be one of them. Quite frankly, I think Monza has to be one of them. I would nominate Spa. I think Spa is the best racetrack in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure if the Belgian countryside would resonate as much with the less than hardcores, with the softer audience. But no, I'm with you. Every sort of event is its own equal entity, although I suppose Monaco has a little bit more cachet. I suppose Silverstone has a little more cachet, just, you know, because the way we've always consumed it over here in Canada is through the lens of British broadcasters like Murray yeah. Walker and now Crofty. So I'm giving them two thumbs up, Mark Daly. I loved everything I heard. I thought it'd be marvelous.
Yeah, my only additional take on what Mark was saying was that I love the idea that he's come up with.
I think that if you're going to have like these major events, you've got to make them regional. You have North America, South America, Asia, the Middle East, so that each geographic region has one. And then I think that one of them, you have to make it the U.S. Grand Prix. I mean, if you can see, I mean, if Miami has that potential, maybe, you know, they get some other tracks in there in the future. Maybe you have some rotating thing. I mean, it seems that they want to at least have two races in the United States. So I think that, you know, from a media point of view, that would be, that has a lot of potential there too. And it is interesting.
There's symmetry there, and I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
It probably should be around the world, given the global nature of the sport. I certainly wouldn't want to turn a Grand Prix I haven't seen yet and has a short history into a quote unquote major.
Yeah.
I like Austin. I'm not sure it's worthy.
Yeah.
Can I throw our hat in the ring for Île Notre Dame in the basin of the St. Lawrence off Montreal, Quebec, Canada? Because it's one of the great tracks on the F1 calendar.
Yeah, absolutely.
It produces drama. It produces unique winners. It produces all sorts of, you know, to me, it's kind of the perfect balance between the new tracks and the huge runoff areas and tire barriers and the danger of a street course, even though it's not really a street course, it's a permanent circuit. I think it would even be a great debate marketing tool to get conversation starting on which ones should be.
Yeah.
The four majors. So I think you'd even have the lead up marketing up and two, where you give fans the opportunity to sort of feel like they're there as part of the construction and the birth of this majors idea.
Yeah.
Grand plans. Yeah, no, fantastic.
Yeah, you know, it is interesting too, the way that you sort of framed it, the way that we view sports from a North American point of view, because a lot of the questions that we get from listeners, especially people that are new to Formula One, is that they can't really wrap their minds around the whole idea of dual championships. It's just like, okay, well, what's the difference between the Drivers' Championship and the Constructors' Championship? Okay, well, obviously one's a team one and one's a driver's one, but how can I equate that to, say, North American sports? And then I always say, I guess the best way that you could look at, say, the Drivers' Championship is something like the Heisman or the Cy Young or like an MVP award, whereas the Constructors is like the Super Bowl or like a championship series. But again,
it's just labels, Mark.
Yeah.
It's just labels, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and there are fundamental differences between sort of European sports structure and North American structure. They do a table, right? Their season is the championship. We do a regular season, then we go on to a playoffs for the championships. There are clearly some things about Formula One that a North American audience has to wrap its brain around that isn't, you know, reflexive. But I don't think there are bridges. I don't think these gaps are too far to bridge by any stretch. I think it's reasonable, particularly now with the point system. I think it's a whole lot easier to follow the sport from a North American point of view than it was in the past.
Matt, let me ask you a question. Just while we're on the theme of North Americans and North Americans coming into the world of Formula One, how critical or special do you think it is that we live in this moment right now where we have not one, but two full-time Canadian drivers on the grid? And if you flash back, the last time we had a driver was JV. He kind of flamed out in 2005 after a bunch of, I don't want to say ill decisions, but bad collaborations with teams and engine issues and all kinds of pieces. And his career kind of flamed out. But we're in a position right now where we have two Canadian drivers. They're both very young. They both obviously come from strong financial backgrounds, but from a personality perspective and a charisma perspective, they're both such great guys. How important do you think that is to the future of F1 in Canada?
Well, obviously, Mark, it would help if they were on podiums from time to time. And, I don't think that's realistic for Latifi right now. I was hopeful it was more realistic for Lance than it has been through five races so far this year. Although I do have hopes there, and I'll get back to that in a second. I mean, let's face it, the sport in our country is two names, one family, Gilles and Jacques Villeneuve. Without those two, I don't think the sport comes close to resonating as much as it has in this country. And you're right, Mark. Like, I was looking at, you know, some F1 driver related the other day, just astonished to see two Maple Leafs there, right? Because, like, you saw two German, if you saw two Union Jacks, even if you saw two Australians, like, you wouldn't bat an eyelash. But to see two Canadians of a very select few, you know, 20 in the world, is quite remarkable. Here's what I'll say. I think Lawrence Stroll is as important and an influential a figure for the sport in Canada as Lance Stroll is.
Mm-hmm.
Because here's the thing. Lawrence has all kinds of swag.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, like, Lawrence is absolutely in the vein of Flavio Briatore and some of the Ferrari principals over the years. The big outsized personalities, right? Like, you know, even to his drive, like, a couple of friends and I like to parrot his line and drive to survive back to each other. I'm the chairman. Not until 12:30, you know, as he checks his you know, like Lawrence is an enormous figure, and if his team started to do better, and let's face it, he wants to win yesterday.
Yep.
If his team did better, like, I think he would be just a marvelous marketing tool in our country, because, you know, like, here's the thing: he's perfect in English, he's perfect in French. You know, he's, so to speak, paid the dues now, buying out a team. Like, he's invested in this sport. Ferrari collector. So he's got a lot of things going for him, both for the dyed-in-the-wool F1 fans, but also people who are newer to the sport. And, you know, but that's barring Lance winning. Like, if Lance were to win, you know, with his charm and good looks and, you know, his personality, and he's articulate in both languages, I mean, if Lance were to win, that's a Canadian sports superstar and enormous marketing tool for the sport.
You know, it's funny when I look at Lawrence and when I look at Lance, I'm immediately intimidated by Lawrence Stroll. I mean, we watched that one clip in DTS where they're sitting in the factory there, and just the way that his eyes are literally on, boring into every single person he's talking to, or just you know, he's digesting every single bit of information. But then when you see Lance, he's like every regular 20-something-year-old Canadian kid, you know, like, he's very relatable. And then at the same time, it's just like I look at Lawrence and I'm just like, yeah, I can totally understand why this guy's like the alpha male billionaire, uber successful in everything he's done. It's just like he has that completely different vibe. And I'm sure that he had that sort of entrepreneurial spirit ever since he was about 2 years old, when he probably, you know, started his first company or whatever it was.
I mean, Lance could fit in a hockey dressing room, right?
Oh, 100%.
He'd be one of the more outgoing hockey players and more upbeat. And he'd always be interviewed on Hockey Night in Canada because they'd love his enthusiasm. But, you know, Lawrence just commands a room. Like, I can only imagine how much Lawrence commands a room when he wants to do it.
Yeah.
You know, he's an all eyes on me type of guy, right? So, yeah, I mean, if they were ever to have any success, they're the natural successors to the Villeneuves in some regard, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the first family, Canada's first family of F1.
Yeah.
It's so important to remember as well. And I'm just looking at his profile right now. Lance is 22. This is his fifth year in Formula One. And I think really the way I kind of put it to this for new Formula One fans, because he skipped Formula Two, right? He won the Formula Three championship. He skipped Formula Two. To me, he kind of skipped college. He's like that NBA player that goes straight to the NBA out of high school.
Right.
I know
that's
he's going to spend a couple years on the bench getting his reps, learning, but now he's in this great package. And to your point, Mark and I were very excited coming into the season thinking that Aston Martin was going to be able to build on what Racing Point had last year. For a number of technical reasons, they're not there yet. And hopefully Monaco's a bit of an inflection point and maybe things will start to turn, but he's still 22. He's still so young. Yeah. And I still think he has tremendous runway. And to be honest, your point about his dad is phenomenal in the sense that long after Lance is out of the sport, Lawrence will either be running a championship team or I could see him running the sport. Do you know what I mean? Like he's got that personality where he could run Liberty.
Yeah. And he loves it.
Yep.
You know, and he's got a little bit of that fear factor like Bernie, although in a much bigger body. well, I mean, I imagine he's physically intimidating as well a little bit, Lawrence. Mark, I hear your point about Lance, and I'm with you, and I'm with both of you. Like, they are effectively Canada's team, if you will. I drive a Jaguar now, and if they were to happen to bring Jaguar back, maybe I'd be a Jaguar fan. But for right now, Aston Martin is Canada's team. And what was I going to say? Here's the counterpoint, Mark. Lance, 22. How old is Max? 23?
Yeah.
Pretty close.
How old was Lewis when Lewis started winning?
He was winning titles at 22.
Yeah. How old was Seb when he started winning?
Yep. Same age.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do the really special ones now separate themselves by 22, 23?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. That becomes
And I hope it's not true. Like, I hope Lance graduates and is like Nico, is like a, you know, a late 20s, early 30s world champion and best in class. But I sort of get the sense now, the way the sport's going, particularly the way we're filling driver spots, that if you're one of the special ones, you're going to get into a cockpit pretty early where you can win. I mean, Lewis did, right, in 07. And, you know, that wasn't very typical. A lot of them had, even Seb worked his way up. But, you know, Lewis got into, it was a McLaren, if I'm not mistaken, in 07, right? And I remember I was on Toronto radio the weekend before the Canadian Grand Prix, and I said, look, there's a new superstar in this sport, and it's a man of color, and we have never seen that in Formula One. And I have a feeling that he's going to win this weekend in Montreal, in the new world, you know, in the world where we're immigrants from everywhere, right? Where everybody comes together, where we have this multicultural harmony in Canada. And Lewis won that weekend, and Lewis has won in North America a whole lot, and it's really started a love affair with Lewis in North America. So, you know, he is the alpha dog, and I think he has tons of fans over here. And north of the 49th parallel, I think that's true as well.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah.
And until Lance wins, I think it's hard to compete with Lewis Hamilton.
Absolutely.
Especially when you have good Canadian boys from Vancouver naming their children
after Lewis Hamilton while carrying the surname. Well, you know, my oldest son's name is Brock, and I keep telling him, he keeps asking me, even though he's 12, he keeps asking me, did you name me because of Brock Besser? And I just say yes. Even though that, you know, he was born long before Brock Besser joined the Vancouver Canucks. But, you know, that's a different story for a different day. We're going to take one final time out here, guys. Matt, I know you wanted to talk a little bit about Monaco. We got a race this weekend. So we'll talk about that in the break here and as we go into our final segment. So, guys, don't go away. We will be right back.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
All right, Mark. So we have gone through the mailbag. We've got some tweets. I don't think we've offended any one of our listeners so far. So we're doing pretty good, you know, for this week, but we still have one segment to go.
That now, right, Mark?
Well, we're trying to keep everybody on side. I think we've done a pretty good job so far. But Matt, I wanted to throw it back to you because when we were talking before we jumped on air tonight, you said you wanted to, you feel obligated to talk about Monaco. And I know this is a talking point for a lot of people every year, and it's still fresh in our minds because we just were there only two weekends ago.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I saw all the chatter. I had people tweeting at me, even people texting at me about Monaco. And, you know, I was like, you mad, bro? Like, what's with all the hate here on Monaco? I suppose it caught me a little bit off guard because I'm so busy following all the other sports for my job that I don't always follow the minutiae of the F1 discussion. And particularly the sort of inside F1 discussion of the Cognoscenti and the Sharps. But I was surprised to see how many of our listeners here in Vancouver, Canada, you know, were messaging me about how terrible Monaco is and there's no passing and the cars are too wide now and qualifying is the only thing worth watching. And maybe I'm old school and nostalgic, but I'll say a few things. Number one, I've seen you guys retweet all the tweets that really render this discussion moot to some degree. Monaco is too significant to the sport from an economic and from a brand standpoint to go anywhere. You know, F1 has, for me, always sold glamour. And there is no more glamorous place than Monte Carlo, Monaco. So to the extent this whole discussion is moot, there are two chief areas where I still really look forward to and love Monaco and have it on my list of Grand Prix I want to go to when you lend me the private jet. even though I know I could probably buy a house in one of the most expensive real estate markets in the world here in Vancouver with what it will cost me to do this race properly. Number one is relatability. A lot of these new tracks, and for safety reasons, but for also racing reasons, are big and wide and have the huge runoff areas, and gravel pits and tire barriers can only be so relatable. When you're racing around Monaco, virtually every camera frame is relatable to viewers. And relatable in a sense that it's, you know, it's fantasy. It's like, oh, look at that. Like, I can never afford to shop in that car shape, but, you know, look, there's a car chaser. There's casino right there. Look at the yachts and the marina, right? Like, I can name you virtually every turn at Monaco, from Saint-Devant to Beau-Rivage to Massenet to the Hairpin, Nouvelle Chicane, like on and on it goes. I can't name you more than a couple of corners at every other track. And only the good ones, too, like the Parabolica and Eau Rouge and, you know, Champions Wall and that sort of thing. So there's a relatability for just human beings, but particularly new fans with Monaco, that you just don't get with big, wide runoff areas, gravel pits, and tire barriers. The second thing is, you know, Murray Walker used to say about Michael Schumacher, he's millimeter perfect. When he pulls into the pits, he's not near his marks. He's millimeter perfect on those marks. That's when they used to have to bring the big fuel hose, as you remember, and fill it up. So where you stopped in that pit was very important. I feel like we've taken a little bit of the precision craft out of the driving with some of the bigger, wider tracks. And Monaco, for me, has the perfect balance of requiring that precision skill, that you want to cut it thin, but not too thin. We saw Latifi hit the wall at the swimming pool, right, in qualifying. We saw pole sitter, Charles Leclerc, cut the corner too tight at the swimming pool and break the Ferrari. I love that element still to racing. You sort of need to be perfect around that corner 64 times, or however many times, however many laps there is. And the best part about Monaco is it's sort of guilt-free because they're never really going fast enough that you fear a heinous accident, that if he gets it wrong there, we're all going to see a scene that we don't ever want to see. Mm-hmm. Like, I love Eau Rouge. I think it's the best corner in racing. But holy bleep, you know, a couple of years ago when Hubert, was it Antoine Hubert?
Yeah.
Went off at that corner. That's something as a racing fan that I just don't ever want to see. Like, nobody should die for this sport. That said, there should be a danger. There should be a fear factor in this sport. That's how we separate some of these drivers. And for me, Monaco has that. It's tight. You got to be perfect with the car. And look, I saw the graphic about, you know, how much longer and how much wider an F1 car is compared to the 70s and 80s when we were racing the same streets of Monaco. And I get it. And it's going to be harder to pass. And I don't want to really hear the complaining from every driver in the paddock There are places that you can do it. Max and others have shown. You put pressure on a leader, he may screw it up through the Nouvelle chicane, and you're going to be able to take the lead. The pit strategy is still there. So, I'm willing to deal with one race a year where we're not seeing passing aplenty or even a lot of opportunity for passing aplenty, given the flip side, given the intangibles that Monaco brings to the table.
Yeah. You know, I'll be 100%. It's not my most favorite track on the circuit.
Yes. Yeah. Sitting here watching me, I'm like, he's listening.
Yeah.
But he don't agree.
No, but
Hamilton looked like he shook his head a couple of times, but I feel like I was talking to, that wasn't the preacher to the choir right there. I'm quite sure by your reaction.
Yeah, no, but I totally agree from the spectacle point of view. And the other thing too is like you say about the precision, because like we had that couple of years ago when Max crashed there in in FP3 and then didn't actually get to qualify, and he ends up starting from the back of the pack, and that is one of those milestone moments, especially in his career, because he didn't have. I mean, he did pretty good in the race. He made up several positions, but obviously it wasn't where he wanted to be. But then it was that big reset for him at that point in his career, because he goes away for 2 weeks. Then they leave Monaco and they go to Montreal. He shows up in Montreal without his entourage. And then we see Max Verstappen 2.0. And that was just one of those in-your-face moments in his career. And incidentally, in that same corner, just coming out of the swimming pool where Charles tagged the wall and crashed in qualifying just 2 weeks ago. So it really is.
Mark, I remember 25 years ago, I saw the retrospective when Olivier Panis won.
Yeah.
When three cars finished. Yeah. Like, it was incredible. Ricardo wins a few years ago. Amazing victory. You know, Lewis had his temper tantrum there a few years ago. You know, Lewis only won there twice, right?
True.
So it tends to produce some surprise winners and some surprise podiums, and particularly in combination with Canada when it's back-to-back with Canada. So I think that's healthy for the sport. Like, the sport's not competitively balanced, as we all know. Mercedes has been on an incredible run of 7 years here, where there hasn't been a question from the opening round in terms of which constructor was the best, which car was the fastest. So yeah, give me the odd track where something haywire could happen.
Matt, you made a point that I've never thought about before, and it really resonated with me as you're speaking, that concept of having a track that is immediately identifiable when you turn on the TV. That's important, because I'll be honest, I watch every race every year, but if I turned on the TV and it was the Chinese Grand Prix, it's going to take me 20 minutes to figure out where the race is. And to your point as well, because they push, obviously for FIA safety reasons, because they push the walls and the grandstand so far back from the track, you can't taste the atmosphere on TV. In reality, because there probably isn't a lot, simply because the spectators that are there are pushed so far back from the track. So to your point, whether the racing's great, whether the racing's mediocre, it's important because it's identifiable, because it's relatable. And we talked a lot about this in the pre-race segment, which is it's got a rich history. And for that reason alone, there's value in having it on the calendar. And people are going to tune in and people are going to watch. And I think they can do things with the cars. And obviously 2022, they're going to push the boundaries of what the cars look like in terms of increasing the degree of parity. But I totally agree with you in the sense that the sport needs consistency in terms of relatable events. Because if it's all the Chinese Grand Prix, it's too generic. It's like a 1980s.
Yeah. The Monaco Grand Prix is the only Grand Prix my mother can instantly identify. You know, like, her men have put her through this sport for however long. But the Monaco Grand Prix is one she'll sit and watch, because she sits there and she likes the Cartier store and the casino and everything, right? and like, here's the thing, like, putting on a Grand Prix race is a massive logistical achievement. And you are subject to things by virtue of time, space, location, you know, all sorts of reasons, economics, where it's hard to get everything perfect. And that's one of the things I've heard about Monaco, is it's not really sort of the best crowd or atmosphere race on the calendar.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's okay. It looks fantastic on television. You want an atmosphere race? Go to Monza. Go to Mexico. They're atmosphere races, right? God bless the Austria-Germany countryside, But it's a long way out for major cities. It becomes logistically difficult for the public to go out there. You know, like I have a friend who's into this sport who is a very successful media executive here in Canada and, you know, has ridden buses 2 hours out to watch, you know, races from the Red Bull Ring and whatnot. If you're going to have a race in a city, in an urban environment, you know, you're probably going to have to surrender some things that if you had more space would be more ideal. So, you know, it's narrow. It's narrow at Monaco. It's narrow at Melbourne. So you deal with the idiosyncrasies of every race in every locale. And I, for one, love to see them racing in cities as well as the countryside. Well, and there is no better city to race in from a backdrop point of view and a setting point of view than Monte Carlo.
Well, that's why it makes it such an interesting prospect to be going back to Baku City this weekend, because we talk about some of these iconic corners. Yeah. I think one of the most bizarre corners I think I've ever seen in my entire life is where you that 20-foot wide entrance into that corner by a castle, of all things. Which
somewhere
is amazing.
In that castle, there's a damsel in distress. It's good storytelling. For the first time I saw Baku, I was like, what the hell is this? There's a damn castle there. They are like, it's got a medieval quality, right? Like the juxtaposition of that machine, many millions of dollars, man-made everything, by this like 500-year-old mortar and block castle. It's just magnificent. I love it.
It's such a stark contrast. You have like this literally space age technology whipping by at 200 miles an hour, and you expect somebody to come, you know, galloping out of the front gates of the castle, you know, knight in shining armor on the back of a horse.
The drawbridge comes down and flattens the park. It's the Atari video game. I love the variety, and frankly, and I've never been to Azerbaijan. I acknowledge, hand in the air. But if there's something in the backdrop of your Grand Prix that is indigenous and can sort of brand your city or brand your country, it's 100 million eyeballs once a year. You couldn't afford to buy it advertising-wise, right? So bravo to Baku. And to Azerbaijan, like they have a track and they've attracted a race that, number one, has provided some really great drama. It's been fun racing there.
Well, I mean,
over brief history, but also has something distinctive and relatable about it, the castle.
Yeah.
That sort of distinguishes it from the rest.
I know Mark wants to jump in here, because as soon as you said like some very you know, memorable moments, I know he wants to talk about Sebastian Vettel and Lewis Hamilton wheel banging each other behind the safety car a couple of years ago. I know that's where you're going to take it, Mark. Am I correct or no?
Close. And I was just going to agree. This is my favorite, honestly. Of all the races on the calendar, this is one of the ones I get most excited about. One, because the backdrop is glorious. It's incredibly unpredictable. It's got tight city streets. It's got the castle as a backdrop. It's got that absurd 2.2-kilometer straight where the cars are hitting 300 kilometers an hour. It's like, it has a little bit of everything, and it's also got some unpredictability. We've seen a manhole cover got sucked up into the bottom. But things you don't normally see. And to your point as well, a few years ago on the podcast that I was working on previously, we did a poll, and the poll was very honestly, have you ever heard of Baku before Formula One went there?
No.
90% of our listeners had never heard of it. The other 10% were lying, straight up lying. As a marketing exercise, this is invaluable for a country. And to your point, Mark, I think some of the most interesting moments from the last couple of years happened there, whether it was Danny Ricciardo driving into the back of Max Verstappen, or Lance Stroll taking a podium, but losing second place, like meters away from the finish line. And Lewis allegedly brake checking Seb, who then bounces into the side of him, and Perez having a couple of great podiums. There's been so much great stuff, and we've only had four races there. It's absolutely crazy.
And Mark, you look at the circuit map, and there's like a hexagon followed by that absurd straight you're talking about. Like, it almost looks like the symbol for male or female. Like, I sit there and I can't conceive of driving it, given, you know, how it's just, you know, like one of these things is not like the other, in terms of, you look at all the circuit maps over the course of the year, Baku stands out. It stands out there too. So I love the fact that we have this sort of stretch in the calendar. And my understanding is Miami's going to go into this spot too, like somewhere around here with Canada and Baku and Monaco, where you're racing in cities. And, you know, in terms of Canada and the Canadian Grand Prix, like, first of all, Circuit Gilles Villeneuve is a fantastic track. But the other amazing thing that we have going for our Grand Prix, and, you know, it's the single most attended sporting event in Canada every year, non-pandemic, so 125,000 people there every year. Like, it absolutely dwarfs the next biggest sporting event in our country. And, of course, we never have 100 million eyeballs on our country sporting-wise either. So all those things apply to us too, Mark, in terms of a marketing play that Baku and Azerbaijan has. Is, you know, this is a man-made island in the basin of the St. Lawrence River. And it looks out onto the skyline of downtown Montreal. Like, it's an incredible marketing tool for that city and for our country. You know, and as someone whose family, you know, all grew up there, and still there, our familial home, you couldn't conceive of the city without the Grand Prix. You couldn't conceive of what, you know, tourism would be like without the Grand Prix. I am glad this pandemic is nearly over, because I endeavor to go see some of these races and drag my girlfriend, like the two of you.
Wait. Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
But before we wrap it up and get some predictions here, you know, it's funny you should say that because when I was watching, you know, the 500 last weekend, it was such a stark contrast, because I'm watching, you know, the race. I'm watching Helio Castroneves win the Indy 500, 130 or 40,000 people in the stands at Indianapolis. And then afterwards, I go down to the grocery store here in Port Moody. I got my mask on and, you know, I'm cringing every time somebody comes within 50 feet of me, right? It's such a weird world that we live in now. But you're just going back to Baku now. Again, a very unique track in and of itself. We've been there three times, three different winners, no repeat winners. We had Ricciardo win in 2017 in the first edition. Then we had Hamilton and Bottas. Last year, we had no Azerbaijan Grand Prix. Again, it is one of the longest tracks on the circuit at just over 6 kilometers or 3.73 miles. It's a shorter in total laps that we run, only 51 laps. I'm just curious, what kind of race are you expecting this weekend, guys? And this one for me is different because it's not quite as tight and as short as Monaco, but it's not a full-on, you know, purpose-built track either. It's sort of a bit of a hybrid in between. So I don't know if this is more advantage Mercedes or advantage Red Bull. So I'll be honest, when trying to figure out who's going to be good at this one, I know it's not going to be Ferrari. I think they had their moment to shine at Monaco, so I think it's going to be back between the usual suspects.
Well, first of all, Mark and Mark, like, amazing. I think we're like 90 minutes into this conversation. Said you'd keep me an hour, so the bill's in the mail.
we agreed on that hourly rate beforehand. So.
I know I'm long-winded. So I'm not going to pretend to know anything about the way these cars are set up for the first time in 2 years at Baku and what could happen here. What I will say and what I will hope, and Hamilton hit it, was, you know, Lance nearly had a second here once upon a time. So hopefully that Aston Martin momentum, if you can call it that, from Seb's finish in Monaco continues here, because I'd like this to be a broader sort of field of contenders for podium this week. But I was going to say, we're 90 minutes in here. We haven't once mentioned the battle at the top with Lewis Hamilton and Max Verstappen, that Verstappen is the driver's leader, that Red Bull is the constructor's leader. Like, honestly, shame on us. We have hit some topics here, but haven't hit the big enchilada. I am just so hopeful that we see these two magnificent drivers, and they are magnificent drivers, both of them. I would bet right now, when it's all said and done, that Lewis Hamilton and Max Verstappen will be top five all-time drivers. Lewis already there, obviously.
Yep. Yeah. But
Max will get there too. He's just a marvelous. He's a prodigy, really. I really hope we see them going toe to toe, in whatever order. You know, somebody asked me today on Twitter when they heard I was doing your podcast, like, "Oh my God, I've been listening to your show for 10 years. You're an F1 fan. Who do you root for?" I said, "No, I don't really root for any team. I root for drivers. Obviously, I root for the Canadians, but I root for Lewis Hamilton and Max Verstappen to have an absolute Donnybrook throughout the year.
Yeah.
You know, for this to be a dogfight right down to the end, toing and froing back and forth. Because, you know, it's been so interesting. We all know the Mercedes doesn't run great when it's not out front. The dirty air. It's not designed, as they say, to pass people. It's designed to run ahead of people. And Max is the opposite, right? Like, Max is very comfortable chasing the rabbit and going for that pass. So I love the fact that we have not only both drivers playing to their strengths, but also in the reverse roles now, right? To mm-hmm. see how they handle it. Lewis is the chaser. Max is the jackrabbit. So I'm just hopeful that what we've seen through the first 5 weeks here extends through, what is it, 17 more races, however many it is, through this season. And if it's to happen at the castle and in Baku on the tight circuit and with the ridiculous straight and the tight corner and like everything that this track has to offer, I'm all for that.
Mark, you look like you're coming up with like a well thought out your response to that. I see the gears turning in your head as you're doing all the math here, how this is going to work out.
Well done. Honestly, I agree with everything Matt said, right? If you're a TV network, if you're a podcast host, if you publish an F1 blog, if you're an F1 Twitter freak, we all want that battle, especially between these two drivers, because on the one hand, Max winning would validate him as an all-time great. Lewis winning in a really tight competition would once again validate him as an all-time great, because hey, you've had a great car, but now you got to go toe-to-toe with somebody with a car that is of an equivalent package. I think it would validate both of them, but all of us would benefit if this goes down to the wire. If the championship's decided in July, the season's a write-off. And I don't think that's going to happen, but hopefully this goes right down to the wire and we're still tuning in at Australia and Saudi for Jeddah and for Abu Dhabi. But I think this weekend, I just feel like Red Bull has that car dialed in. Sergio Perez has had a lot of success at this track. He secured a couple of podiums, especially after last Sunday. He seems more comfortable in that car than he had in any previous weekend. Feel like it could be a big weekend for the Red Bull team, and hopefully for Bottas as well. You know what? I'm not the biggest Bottas fan. He's a great guy. He doesn't deserve the bad luck he's had this year. That pit fiasco, that was unfortunate. I don't assign any blame to him. Being taken out by Russell in week two, that was tough. But hopefully, as much as I want a close drivers' championship, I want a close constructors' championship as well. Yes. Because then it's not so much just about talking about Max and Lewis, but what's happening between Valtteri and Sergio. Because one of the two of them is going to help decide the constructors' championship.
Well, and Mark, what I would interject, and if I'm not mistaken, Daly put it on the notes. We just haven't gotten to it yet. Is Valtteri in that Mercedes all year? Because, you know, I've seen the stuff on Russell wanting to know by summer break.
Yeah. It's a great question, isn't it?
Frankly, I think it's been 3 years in a row now where Valtteri's won a race or been close to winning a race early in the season. or been felled by some sort of awful mechanical problem early in this. Bottas isn't a contender here.
Yeah.
Russell is a contender. I can understand how, you know, there's politics involved here, and Mercedes wants Lewis to be the lead driver again this year. But can we imagine how great it would be if George Russell's in the other Mercedes at some point later this year? That could be amazing.
Yeah.
To me, that's the four best drivers the two teams have had in some time. That would get me really excited, because a push from below for Lewis on top of the push with Max, you're a 7-time world champion.
Prove it.
Let's put you in the hot water and see if you're a teabag still, right? Let's see if you can handle it. I would love to see those storylines later this season. And frankly, I think Russell is just better than Bottas right now.
Yeah, it is interesting too, because there was that story that was circulating this week that after that debacle, that pit stop in Monaco, that I think Toto Wolff was saying, oh, you know, Valtteri didn't stop, 100% on his marks or something like that. And then so the wheel gun went on there crooked, and then, that shredded the wheel nut and everything like that. And Bottas, he said, no, well, if I go and look at it, I was pretty much spot on my marks when I went in for my pit stop. So I'm kind of wondering, is this the first kind of public, the building the foundation to kind of let him down slowly, right?
I'm not sure if I totally buy that from Toto. That said, Murray Walker, Michael Schumacher, millimeter perfect, right?
Yeah.
Bottas wasn't millimeter perfect. I'm not surprised. And then, the other thing I read is that Toto really got into Russell for the accident with Bottas at Imola.
Yeah.
And frankly, that was George's fault. He got side by side and he lost his nerve a little bit.
Yeah.
It wasn't Valtteri's fault. It was George's fault. I think George knew it. I think George knew it even before he hit the barrier. And I think he was so rebellious about it and on the radio screaming at Bottas because he knew it. And I think Martin Brundle was great to point that out on the broadcast. But, that Toto was all over him about that, to me, is a signal.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that, Toto wants George to be the next one. Toto wants George in that Mercedes sooner rather than later. And that George sort of messed up in a moment of big pressure and Toto got all over him, gives me a little bit of an insight in terms of the timetable here.
Mm-hmm.
And George into a Mercedes. And, I think it happens this year. I do think it happens. I think you're going to get to the point like Albon in a Red Bull and like Gasly in a Red Bull where you just cannot sacrifice the second car as often as the current driver is sacrificing points in the second car to get to the team goals. Horner said something on Drive to Survive about Albon, where he said, I just can't remember the last time he's done the job. Qualified on the second row, finished fourth. That's all we're asking. Shit, we're not asking you to win the race.
Yeah.
We're asking you to win maximum points as the second car. And I think Valtteri's going to have an issue with that as this year goes along.
Yeah, it kind of makes you wonder that the more that Red Bull's able to apply the pressure with that second car and Sergio Perez to that maybe force Mercedes' hand a little bit into making that decision. Because, as Wolf always says, we're not here chasing wins, we're chasing perfection. it's that they want to be as perfect as possible. And which I guess is an admirable thing to be, a goal to have, if you're trying to be perfect, but they don't like to live.
Wins, can he give some to Aston Martin and he can have his perfection. If we get a Canadian win, I'd be happy with that, fellas.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, Matt, I think this is a good place to tie it up nicely. We promised we were going to just keep you for an hour. It's been about 7 hours and 38 minutes, but if I look at the counter here, so we appreciate you hanging out. Really thrilled that you're able to come and hang out with us. And again, congratulations on you and Blake, and I'd like to say the new show, but the revived show. So before we let you go, just let everybody know where they can follow you guys online. I apologize. This isn't as nearly as luxurious or as maybe well-appointed as the blanket fort that you guys have, but we try our best.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we're building a studio right now, so we're in a temporary location as we speak. But well, first of all, fellas, just delighted that we connected here. We have two so sophisticated, knowledgeable fans and podcasters on Formula One here in my community of Vancouver, BC, Canada. It's thecarisonprice.com. It's 3 to 6 p.m. Pacific time each and every day. We're also available on podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. I don't necessarily feel like our audiences cross over all that much because, you know, 3 to 4 hour talk show in Canada for 10 years. And, you know, we don't talk a ton of F1 because it's just not really what the audience demands here just yet. But let's hope we built it a little bit here tonight. And let's hope the three of us continue to build it here in our hometown. Certainly, we're no Drive to Survive, nor could we be. but I'm happy to indulge all the sort of new fans and the ones that have questions and who want to continue this conversation or more F1 conversations across my social channels at Matt Sakaris on Twitter. We're on Instagram as well at Sakaris Price. Just delighted to make both of your acquaintances. And I hope that, you know, and for some across the world, this will be strange, but some of the races actually come on at night in Vancouver, BC. At 30 p.m. starts or a 12:30 p.m. start. And on those occasions, guys, I'd be delighted to meet up with you somewhere out in the city.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Knock the glass. Yeah. And watch and experience a race together. So thanks for having me on. Thanks for the time.
It's a pleasure. We'll leave the jet at the airport that time. We'll pick you up in the private helicopter and we'll do something.
Something tells me that the 26-hour flight to Abu Dhabi is going to go just like that. Yeah. The conversation that's going to flow, Jen. So thanks very much.
Thank you again. Appreciate Ladies and gentlemen, Matt Sakaris joining us again tonight. And again, if you want to get in touch with us, you can do so on Twitter at ScuderiaF1Pod, or you can get in touch via the email at ScuderiaF1Pod@gmail.com. And that's it. That's a wrap. We will be back in a couple of days to recap the Azerbaijan Grand Prix and whatever drama and excitement unfolds. And until then, have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you guys again in a couple of days. Bye for now.